Welcome to the Arcady Group Thinkers podcast. I'm Justin McCord. With me is Ronnie Richard. And Ronnie, I feel like I'm in the Severance offices. I don't know if you can see how sterile this...
It's good timing for season two, right?
I don't remember.
You don't even know where you are right now. Or the other half of you doesn't.
I'm glad that that made you giggle like that. That's a good way to start. So this is interesting. The conversation that we're going to have today with Gabe Cooper, founder and CEO of Virtuous. What I find so interesting about Gabe is I don't know that I've ever heard anyone peel back the layers of Gabe. And so the opportunity to do that really excited me in this conversation. Tell our audience a little bit more about Gabe and some of your thoughts on our conversation.
Sure. As you mentioned, Gabe is the founder and CEO of Virtuous, and he's also author of Responsive Fundraising, the donor-centric framework helping today's leading nonprofits grow giving. And so, you know, Gabe has a very strong focus on how technology can help nonprofits through both his work and his book. And one of the things we dug into a little bit was, where did this intersection of generosity and purpose begin? And you'll hear in the episode that he refers back to as a kid being taught this generosity by his parents and his family growing up, and then the technology side of it came in actually through music, which is pretty fascinating to me. I don't know what you think.
Yeah. That combination, you'll hear him use the phrase pattern recognition, as it relates to both technology and then into music and how that, is a through line in his work and multiple startups. I'm completely biased, Ronnie, about the conversations that we get to have and the opportunity that we get to understand a little bit more about the people behind the work, and so just really appreciate getting to hear someone who is highly visible as a founder and who is, you know, kind of a classic founder brand in a way with Gabe's prominence in the space, and to hear a little bit of his heart, his motivation, and really how he thinks about leadership was something that fulfilled me as a part of our conversation. So our audience can look forward to that and hearing the winding road that almost feels like a Beatles reference for Gabe as a music fan, of Gabe Cooper, CEO and founder of Virtuous on the Thinkers podcast. All right, Gabe, I warned you that that we were going to talk about you. And so, unless you want to, phone a friend and have us talk to them about you. I've been thinking about there's a lot of stuff that I want to understand and unpack, but where in the world did the idea of combining nonprofits and technology, when did that pop on your radar? What was the moment that was like, yes, this is the course I want to go?
Yeah, it's a good question. There's an evolution, probably a few different moments in time. But early in my career, I'm old, so I was a software developer in the first .com boom and bust, and love software development, love building product. But then, as you might imagine, got a little bit disenfranchised. There was a lot of rowdiness and a lot of dumb decisions that weren't necessarily good for the world back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And so had the sense there's got to be more meaning than this stuff I'm doing right now. So that was sort of one moment. I actually went to work in the nonprofit space. And I think that that made me think, I really like nonprofits, and also I work at a slightly faster pace than most of these organizations and want to have an impact beyond just one nonprofit. And I think probably the third moment was for about 8 years, I ran an agency. We did custom software development, some digital fundraising kind of stuff. And I think we just got, or I got a lot of pattern recognition working with a lot of big nonprofits, like very common tech challenges that were standing in the way of generosity. I mean, we go from one organization to another having to build custom stuff on top of their existing tech stack just to help them do the bare minimum of the right thing to do for their donors, right? I'm like, gosh, this is ridiculous. All of these orgs are handcuffed to like tooling, data systems, even how their teams are structured that are preventing them from growing the way they need to grow to like to serve their mission. And it was, I think it just grew out of frustration of seeing that year after year after year is like somebody has got to fix this problem. And then at some point it just dawned on me, oh shoot, maybe you're the one that's supposed to help fix this problem. So that happened about 10 years ago. But I think for me, more than anything, my like personal passion in life is generosity, right? So like not just part of it's these organizations we get to work with, they're doing amazing work and generosity funds at work. But a lot of it for me is actually what it does in the heart of the donor, right? So when people give away their time or their money, they tend to be a lot less selfish, a lot more focused on their neighbor, which in the world we live in seems to be a pretty valuable thing. And so I think that's the thing that kind of animates me and gets me up every morning.
I think you're saying there's like a Venn diagram of you that's across of generosity and technology. When you were younger as a kid, did you notice a lean toward either of those two things? Like a lot of times someone who grows up to be an engineer, as a kid, they take things apart and they were constantly tinkering with things. Were you drawn into software and developments early or anything like that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I've thought some about that. I mean, I grew up in like a sort of a faith community in my household. My parents were very, very generous people, always thoughtful of others. So I think I saw that modeled in an early age for my parents on the generosity side. On the tinkering side, it's funny, like a lot of software engineers, you'll find this, but they're actually drawn more toward music. So yeah, tinkering, like I was good in physics and math. I liked building, but it's actually the creative energy around music. You walk into any room of 20 software developers, I guarantee you half of them are musicians. There's just something about that. And so I always loved music as a kid and I love creating music. And so it's a weird connection between the two, but there's something about this like craftsmanship plus creativity that just like fires up something in my brain that I really like. And so as weird as it sounds, it may have actually been music that drove me more toward that sort of desire to build.
Like a blend of structure and creativity.
Yeah.
Well, and you used the phrase pattern recognition earlier, which my mind immediately goes to music whenever you said that. What do you play?
I don't play anything well, but for years I played in bands and I played guitar, bass, mandolin, a few different things, and had a small record label in my early 20s that was a complete train wreck. I couldn't make a dime off of it, but it allowed me to produce music in my house for several years, which is fun.
So I actually had no idea. That's awesome. This is the kind of stuff that I love getting into. So, I knew about Brushfire as an agency, and then obviously knowing about Virtuous, but even starting a record label. So you're a serial entrepreneur.
Yes. If you want to count the record label, then yes. And so that's my, that's my get your massive failure out of the way early on. And so you can figure out how to do the right kind of stuff. And so, yeah, those, and then we had a mobile app company with two buddies that was made mobile apps for golf primarily, but then a few other sports as well. And so Virtuous is technically my fourth, but it will definitely be my last. Not number one, because it fulfills a personal passion for me that I just love. But number two, you just get to a certain age where starting with a blank sheet of paper again, it just is overwhelming.
You mentioned those learning from failures. What did you learn from those startups that didn't take off, like what have you applied lessons to what you're working on with Virtuous today?
Yeah. I mean, I think with all of my companies, there have been like sort of miniature failures or sheer panic moments or existential crisis along the way. And I think there's probably learnings. I mean, in that initial record label, I realized really quick, like, hey, you have to, number one, you have to be really good at something. I think I was very mediocre. But number two, like just sort of business fundamentals are a little bit lost on you in your early 20s. Like you have to sell stuff for money and you have to make more money than you spend, right? A lot of the times, like you even see this in early startup founders, there's this sort of like dream big aspirational vision of the universe, which I absolutely love, but it's sometimes not anchored to like the fundamentals of you have to build something that people will buy and you can't spend all of your money. You know, it's it's weird to say that, but I think that's a pretty common trait for people in their early 20s.
Yeah, that maturation process is fascinating. You know, whenever you can, when you're in a place where you can look back on it and see those growth steps and those growth lessons. Now that you have, you all have experienced a tremendous amount of success and been able to make a dent for so many nonprofits in terms of what they accomplish through, you know, connected infrastructure. How do you think about, as the leader, as the CEO of an organization that has high visibility in, a relatively large sector, it feels small at times, but relatively large sector, how do you think about what that looks like to lead, and have that founder-led approach, in the market?
Yeah, it's interesting, especially in B2B SaaS. I think if you look at vertical software as a service generally in the nonprofit space and in other sectors as well, there is always this sort of fear of losing your soul. A lot of times it's like maybe private equity money that comes in or a bunch of things being slammed together or the founding team leaving and you being left with a bunch of folks in suits that don't really know or care about your customers, right? And so that's something that we have to sort of battle against every day to fight for our soul, if that makes sense. And so part of it's just bringing the right people around the table and not getting out over your skis, controlling your own destiny so you can make the right decisions. And by right decisions, I mean, like at Virtuous, and for me personally, it's always about the product and our customers, nothing else. Like we have to do amazing research and development to build the best non-products, the best products for our nonprofits, right? And so like, I hate the fact that for years, people have looked at nonprofit tech and said, yeah, that's probably 20 years behind the rest of the world. I think nonprofits should be out ahead, right? And so we have to like sort of hire a team and create a vision that's really what nonprofits deserve. And the second part is just being like customer obsessed. Like everybody on our team, we expect them to like sort of care deeply about the organizations that we serve. Our customer experience team always says default to yes, which means like, hey, if a nonprofit calls and they said this thing stinks, you default to like, yeah, I'm gonna assume you're right about that, and I'm gonna lean in and figure out what you care about in the world. Like, you know, a lot of that for us means we spend a lot of time volunteering at our customers, going on site with our customers, like working with them shoulder to shoulder. But I think if you can sort of ingrain a culture of like product-led, customer-obsessed, and that permeates the whole organization, like it makes a big difference. And it makes it for a fun place to work too, honestly.
You used a couple of words in there that I just want to call out. You used obsessed, customer-obsessed, and you talked about you putting your soul into the work. Obviously, that's a lot of time and effort you're committing to your role as CEO, as to be expected in a leadership role like that. How do you balance that work-life balance and finding time to do things outside of the office?
I don't think I did that well early in my career. It's a lesson I had to learn. I probably ran way too hard, right? And like burned it at both ends for too many years, which I regret in some ways. I think you know, for me now, like one of the things with my family is I commit to being what I say is indispensable at home, meaning like I'm integral to our nighttime routine at our house and I don't want to give that up, right? So my 10-year-old daughter expects me to put her to bed every night and that's just something that I'm not going to sacrifice on anymore, right? To get to that point, so if you still want to deliver with excellence and have some sort of balance, it really means hiring really good leaders that are smarter than you, right? So I think that's the thing, especially I think over the last 5 or 6 years, that's been my top priority as a CEO is I have to identify and retain or attract and retain great talent. Like I have to hire people that are all better at their job than I could ever be. And then I'm not up at 10 in the morning trying to cover off on something I shouldn't be covering off on. And so, as a CEO, it really is about, you have to create a very coherent vision of where you're going. Then everybody has to be bought into that vision. You have to make sure you don't run out of money. But then the third and probably the most important at our stage is, yes, you have to attract and retain amazing talent and be incredibly selfish and greedy about the kind of talent you get on your team.
It makes me think about a little bit of Max Dupree and Leadership as an Art is a book that I was given, you know, 10 or 12 years ago. And we talk about amongst our leadership team quite a bit that, you know, the role of a leader is to first define reality for their team. And so, you know, whether or not that reality is like the state of play or how we want to show up for our clients, like that defining those pieces of reality. And the second team is get out of their way. Like to your point, the old David Ogilvy-ism of hire people that are smarter than you and get out of their way. I think those are also signs of maturation that come from time and opportunity. Those two lessons were things that I learned from specific individuals that I watched and that I have been fortunate to be mentored by. Who, there are a lot of people that look to you in your organization and or in the sector that you have been able to speak into their lives. Who has spoken into your life over your virtuous tenure that has mentored you and helped you grow or help you overcome unforeseen obstacles along the way?
Yeah, I think for me, I you know, me and this group of people that I hang with, we always talk about durable friendships. And so there's a group of other CEOs and leaders that I'm not mentored by as much as like really good friends with that are also in the thick of it with me. And why I say use the word durable in friendship is like somebody can read a Peter Drucker book and just tell you business truisms. But it's another thing when you have like folks that are actually in the trenches with you that care about you deeply, that care about your family, that get to know you, that can actually say words that are more specific and true, right? And so I think being a founder and a CEO can be lonely, especially if you're a solo founder. Just you feel the weight of the world is on your shoulders. And so I actually think that durable friendships with like-minded folks that you can be arm in arm with is actually the thing that makes the difference more than just like the sort of the older Peter Drucker figure in your life that's going to just tell you business wisdom, right? I mean, all of the content is all out there and consumable. It's like the application of that content in the thick of it that matters, if that makes sense. That's good. And the other thing is I've been pretty picky about who we invite in as investors and who's on my board. And so those relationships aren't contentious. I've even told people when they're entering my board, like, I'm going to be really transparent here. Like, I'm not going to sugarcoat anything. And I need people around the table with me that are okay with that and are willing to be shoulder to shoulder with me, like you and me against the problem. And by sort of having a board with that dynamic at Virtuous, it's allowed me to sort of garner the wisdom of a set of folks who've all been there before and have pattern recognition. And so that sort of authentic transparency combined with really smart people helps.
In your, I think, decade plus of since starting Virtuous, you've obviously worked with a ton of nonprofits and helped them improve their fundraising, streamline their fundraising. What are there any memorable stories or moments that stand out to you that you just recall instantly of, man, that was a great opportunity we helped that group out with?
You know, this is a story I've told 1,000 times, but it's, I don't know why it sticks with me so much. It's actually happened in the really early days of Virtuous. So for anybody listening that's heard this, I apologize, but man, it's just so cool. We have a feature in Virtuous that it's like, hey, here's the next calls that you should probably make today. So if you're like a major gift officer or something, you don't know what to do with the next 15 minutes of your life. Like, here's the next, 10 calls you should probably make. We had, a woman who was heading fundraising for a human trafficking organization. They were about 10 grand short of being able to run this project where they're going to, into Southeast Asia and rescue people out of human trafficking. And so she was panicked. She wanted to get the number. She pulls up that list, calls down the list, and within about 30 minutes had raised all $10,000 to be able to get the project rolling, and was so stoked about it. She actually drove to our office and bought a couple of our software developers lunch as a way to say thank you, because she had time on her hands again. And so just like that, the dynamic of, hey, using data to drive giving in a way that like saves you time, and then just seeing the direct impact of that in the field of people being rescued, and then having the tie back to like my team getting to give each other a high five and our customer a high five, like all in a 48-hour span, is just pretty special.
It's all around.
Yeah,
that's awesome. It's so indicative, I think, a little bit of the culture, and obviously of so much of what you have been come to known be known by, which is that responsive mindset, the responsive framework, and the book, and it's something that. Even spills out in those sorts of stories, right? That, the proactivity behind it and having that even a part of the features that turn into those kind of stories. That's fantastic. Kind of rounding out as you look ahead, over the next decade plus, and you said, this is your, ideally, this is your last startup and founder scene. Who knows what that story looks like down the road? But as you look ahead, what excites you about this particular time in fundraising and where you see Virtuous helping nonprofits solve some pretty heady problems right now?
Yeah. There's a couple of things there. I think broadly, our mission is we want to create $10 billion in net new generosity in the world. So we measure like the how much you were doing where you were going before and how we sort of leveled that up. And so at this point, we've measurably created about $1.2 billion. And so I really want to get to that $10 billion mark. I think what that looks like probably over the next 5 to 10 years for nonprofits is going to be leaning into things like AI. Right. So if you think about the typical problems that a nonprofit's facing, well, if it's around responsive fundraising, how do I create a more personal relationship with my donors to get them to act? It's about things like predicting behavior. Like I want to figure out what my donors are most likely to do next or what they're really into, what moves the needle for them, and to be able to communicate effectively in a nuanced way against each of those, whatever their behaviors are or their interests are. AI can be an incredibly powerful tool and help predict those kind of behaviors and provide people with the right next steps, right? So I think, that's going to be it's a really important for us on our roadmap, like how we're building into that reality. But I think it's going to be really powerful for nonprofits. I think the other thing that's true about software, especially SaaS, is like will shift dramatically over the next 5 to 10 years. I think historically the idea with SaaS is that you want software as a service, you want software that helps you do your job better, right? So everybody's trying to build software that helps you do your job better. The thing that's changed even over the last month or 6 months is the expectation is now I want software to do my work for me. It's a completely different fundamental shift. And so that in you know, I'm sure probably many people listening have heard the buzz around things like AI agents, but the idea with AI agents is you're using AI to be able to figure out what to do next, but you're actually having the software take action and do the work for you. For me, a few examples of that look like, I don't have time to write a personalized email to everybody on my list, but AI should know enough about the language of your organization, what really resonates with your donors, to be able to craft copy and creative in real time that's personalized for each donor, right? Like, it shouldn't be hard to get data in and out of my database. AI should be smart enough to recognize data, sort through it, shove it in and out of my database. It should be smart enough to know that, hey, this person might be a good recurring donor. I can probably automate a series of text message and emails to them to be able to convert them to be a recurring donor without anybody having to lift a finger on my team, right? I mean, this is the world we're moving into, where AI agents, AI plus automation is beginning to do the work for you. So yeah, it's a long rambling way of saying, this is what gets me excited. This is what's on our roadmap. And I think it can be a game changer for fundraising.
And the beauty of that is, we all know at nonprofits, people wear so many hats and they have so much on their plate often, and they're being asked to do more and more. And even when you think about, we keep getting more and more channels and more different ways to communicate with donors. And that's more and more ways to that tasks that people have to do. So if we can use AI and automation, these tools you're referring to free up some tasks, I mean, what a game changer that is.
When I go into fundraising teams, I think the two competing priorities are always like, hey, our donors are more distracted than ever, right? They're seeing 7,000 ad messages a day. They're in doom scrolls on social media. They're getting personalized content to them. It's harder and harder to break through because people are more and more distracted. And I don't know how to break through that and connect with people personally in a way that makes sense to them, right? And the other hand is like, I have a limited team and really strapped for time. I have 10,000 people, 100,000 people on my file, and I have like 6 people. Like, the math doesn't work for me to actually build a personal relationship, right? So you have both of those tensions pulling at the same time. And I think that's what we've been building at Virtuous for the last 10 years, is solving for that problem. But I do think AI combined with automation or AI agents are the next wave in how you begin solving both of those problems at scale.
Gabe, we look forward to seeing what you and Virtuous have coming in the next few years. Before we wrap up here, I just got one last question that we didn't answer earlier, and that's, what was the name of your record label?
It's a great question. Caspian Hum Records. So Caspian Hum, H-U-M. It's after the C.S. Lewis book, Prince Caspian. So it's like what Narnia looks like when everything is put right.
Love that book. Love the Narnia series.
I feel like there's an insight into Gabe in that specific instance, like that reference.
That's awesome.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Gabe.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much. It's been a fun conversation.
Group Thinkers is a production of RKD Group. For more information, including how you can partner with RKD to accelerate growth for your fundraising and nonprofit marketing needs, visit rkdgroup.com.